Charlie. Appreciate that. Wanda Garner had some technical issues last night with the bulletin, and she wanted me to apologize because there's some things that are missing out of here, like the pantry items. I think she said Joe needs canned goods. Fruit. She needs fruit and some other things. So I'm sorry. That's the apology. We had I had announced 2 weeks ago that we were going to start a new series, and I don't have any idea how long it's going to last. I think about 30 weeks, maybe. Well, I have a study guide that has 31 chapters, and one of the chapters I'm not going to use. So if we can make a chapter a week, that's about how. But the title of this is A Survey of Church History. And I think it's a good study because it's important to understand how the church got to where it is today from where it started back there on the day of Pentecost so long ago. The church is one foundation, and its foundation is Jesus Christ the Lord. And when our Lord Jesus came as the Son of God in the flesh, and he died on a Roman cross back there almost 2,000 years ago, it marks a central point in the history of mankind. That central point is recognized by everyone around the world. I mean, that's when time made a change. Everything before that was before Christ, or before the common era, it is now BCE, and everything after that was after Christ. So it really was a midpoint in the history of mankind. When he said on that cross, when he bowed his head and said, "It is finished," that marked the completion of a long chain of events that had taken place according to his divine guidance. The death of Christ was neither accidental nor was it incidental. But it was like Peter preached on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 and verse 23. When he told those listeners to him, he said, "It's by this that you with lawless hands have taken him and have crucified him and have killed him." And what that "this" was that it was the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God. It was by that this happened. In other words, it wasn't accidental and it wasn't incidental, but it was always in the plan of God that those events would take place and that they would take place just where they did. All that had gone on leading up to the death of Christ was done in preparation for that great event, from the fall of man in the garden through the patriarchs, through the prophets, prophesying the coming of the Messiah. God's plan began to unfold. We can, looking back now, see how Moses' law was a tutor, a teacher. It was a tutor to bring us to Christ. But those people back there didn't know. It takes a backward look from us now after all of this history has taken place. It takes a backward look to see that truly was a tutor to bring us to Christ. Before Moses' law, there was no law. There was no transgression because there was no law. And the law was given so that they would have a law and something that they had to abide by and something for which there were consequences if there was infractions of that law. So we can see now how it worked that way. However, the revelation and this is in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 5. The revelation of the mystery of Christ, he says, that which in other generations was not made known unto the sons of men. I've got something going on with my throat. Jerry, I think you're going to have to finish this. Thank you. Appreciate it. I have a cough drop. Feels like I have something stuck right there. Yeah, that'd be good. Thank you, Charlie. I've got some in this refrigerator on this side that says Tidwell's water on it. That's so that it stays there. But if anybody starts choking during church, you're welcome to use Tidwell's water. Please, please do get it. I had brought water once before, and I went to get some in a few days, and it was all gone. But anybody's welcome to it if they need some water, for sure. I think, though, in order to understand the history of the church, I think that it's important that we understand some things that were going on in the world where the church was born and in the world where the church lived. And that's what I want to turn our attention to this morning. Now, I don't think there's any great, deep, spiritual, religious truths that are going to be revealed in the things that we're going to talk about today, but rather just to go over a little bit the things, you know, what kind of world did Jesus live in as a boy, for instance? What kind of world did he grow up in? What kind of world was it when he started his public ministry? But because all of these things that we're going to talk about this morning both influenced the church, they influenced the growth of the church, they influenced the life of the church through the next few centuries. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Is this
going to
be okay?
It is. It is on tape. Sure is. Every session will be. I think just about everything that is said in the microphone here is on a CD somewhere and can be listened to it. But the political, the social, the philosophical, and all of the religious influences in the world back in the first century had a lot to do with the spread of the gospel. Some of the things were influential in the establishment of the church and the spread of the gospel for good and actually helped the process. Some things, though, hindered the spread of the gospel through intellectual argument and literally physical persecution. The Christians were persecuted back in those days. But I like to think in terms of when Jesus was taken up on the highest pinnacle of the temple in Jerusalem, when he looked down, what would he see? And you know, I like to, in lessons like this, I like to try to take us back there so that we can see the things. We see artist renderings of the city of Jerusalem, and they're beautiful with pine trees or palm trees and things like that and painted colors and all this. Jerusalem in the first century wasn't like that at all. Jerusalem was dusty. It was dirty. It was a city that was trying to exist right on the northern edge of the Negev Desert. It was hot. It was humid. And people had to exist in that. But yet it was the center of life for the Jew. And that's what we're getting to as we go through these kinds of things. So when one looked down from the top of the temple, Herod's temple was a little smaller than Solomon's temple, but you would have been struck with the architectural genius, I think, of Herod's temple. Just the sheer size of the stones and the precision with the cut and the fitting. It was truly one of the wonders of the ancient world just to see that. And by far, the finest structure in Palestine anywhere and in most of the known world at that time. But as one looked down, you would see Roman soldiers, lots of Roman soldiers in the streets being served by slaves that were captives from the many battles that they had been in. You would see the temple priests coming and going with sacrifices, either leading animals or carrying small animals with sacrifices and incenses. You would see women with water pots, always women with water pots, because they had no hot and cold running water. The only way a household had to have water is they had to take a water pot and go to the central wells or springs and get the water and take it home. So there was always women with water pots and children. You'd see farmers with donkeys or carrying big baskets, taking their goods to the market to sell or to trade. and all of those kinds of things were going on there. 40 miles westward from Jerusalem was the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. And 1,500 miles beyond that, to the northwest, was what men had called the most wonderful city in the world. It was the city that was called Rome. And it took 3 months to make the trip from Jerusalem to Rome. But through the sheer political genius of the Roman Empire, they had been able to make themselves known in every small town and village and hamlet throughout the entire empire. And Palestine was no exception. There were the Roman soldiers and the accompanying tax collectors that were everywhere and ever reminded the Jews that they were subject to a power that was somewhere else rather than subject to the authority of their own leadership. Augustus Caesar had instituted a policy of non-intervention in the affairs of the empire. In other words, people from outside, provincial people, did not interfere into the affairs of the central government. However, it didn't take a whole lot to inspire these people to rebellion, these people, these freedom-loving, chosen people of God, the Jews. It didn't take very much to inspire them to speak out against the central government. There were obvious benefits for this powerful central government, too. Some of these benefits, as I said a few minutes ago, were influenced for good, and they aided in the spread of the gospel and in the establishment and spread of the church. Other things were not so good. But first, Rome had been involved in some serious civil wars within the empire. When all of these civil wars were complete, Augustus Caesar managed to obtain from the Senate autocratic power. And with this autocratic power, he brought peace to the empire. First time since the establishment of Rome, since the Romans defeated the Grecians for control of this great world empire. And this was the first time that they had peace because they were so busy going out and doing battles and wars and conquering other nations and bringing provinces into the empire. And this was seen as a great boon to the people, and it made the environment better for the spread of the gospel. Also, opening the world up to travel and to trade. In each one of the great world empires, from the Babylonian Empire through the Medo-Persian Empire, and then the Grecian Empire, and then lastly the Roman Empire, and those are the four, that's not all of the great world empires, but those are the four that Daniel prophesied back there in the book of Daniel. And each one of those brought something positive to the world. The Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar was a smart guy. He was a great builder. He was great at construction. He rebuilt all of the cities and towns around, and he rebuilt them all to great splendor. He built stone bridges, things that would last. And also from the Babylonian Empire, the world got good farming techniques and the innovation of irrigation, which was something that they weren't able to do before, which ensured crops could be grown and they weren't so dependent upon the weather and droughts and famines and things of that nature, or famines that are brought about by droughts. So they had peace in the empire. The other thing was opening the world up to travel and trade. The Romans built good roads, and this was the first time that there were good roads. They mostly traveled on paths, and people would just make the paths as they were going from one place to another. But the Romans actually dug them out and paved them with cobblestones and things like that. Remnants of some of those old Roman roads can still be seen in that part of the world near the ruins of the cities even today. Also, the Roman Empire brought a common currency to everyone across the empire, was on the same monetary system. This, coupled with the new infrastructure, the good roads to travel on, together they encouraged trade and free trade across a wider piece of real estate. So commerce flourished during these days. However, wealthy they may have been, though, it couldn't long continue, because within the Roman government itself, the imperial administration, there was already the seed of the very thing that would cause its downfall. Two things, really: slavery and extravagance. There, the Roman Empire existed primarily on a system of slave labor. It was the basis of this materialistic and industrious empire. It was a system of degraded forced labor, and it rendered free labor as disgraceful and unprofitable. And the extravagance of the imperial administration was so wasteful that it wasted the prosperity of the entire world in such record time that taxation became so burdensome and so oppressive on the people that they impoverished the most fertile of the countries within the Roman Empire. And of these taxes, there were two kinds of taxes. One was an annual tax. There were city councils that were set up in all of the areas around the Roman Empire. And these city councils were the ones that collected the annual tax. And it gave the Roman Empire a guaranteed annual revenue source. They would go to there were no ends that they wouldn't go to collect this tax either, because failure of the city councils to collect that tax and pay it to the central treasury made the responsibility for the money fall on them. The other tax is the one possibly that we're most familiar with, which was the direct tax. Now, this was the kind of taxes that men like Matthew would have collected, men like Zacchaeus. He was a tax collector. He would have collected the direct taxes. They got the privilege of being able to collect the direct taxes went to the highest bidder, a wealthy individual who was able to deposit huge amounts of money into the central treasury as a guarantee that the taxes would be collected and that they would be paid on time. The profit from the tax collectors then came from whatever amount of money they were able to exact from you above the amount of what your taxes were. And they had every reason to oppress the tax payer. In Palestine, they were generally Jews, like Zacchaeus, and they were looked upon as traitors to their race. In the social order of things, at the top of the Roman social order was, of course, the Roman emperor. Then after that came senators, knights, citizens, provincials, freeborn, slaves, and beggars. And I really have two of these out of order on the slide there. The freeborn should be under the citizens. Freeborn is what the Apostle Paul was. He was born in the city of Tarsus, and Tarsus was a Roman colony. It was a wholly owned possession of the Roman Empire, and so he was freeborn. He was a Roman citizen. Provincials were the people that lived in Jerusalem. They were people that lived in Syria. They were people that lived in Persia, which is the modern-day Iran. But those people were part of the Roman Empire at this time. And those were provinces that came about through conquest, through military conquest. So the provincials, they came after the freeborn in the social order. then there were slaves, and then there were just beggars. Besides these general divisions of the society, there were also classes and subdivisions according to professions and trades as well. Social inequalities were also fostered by prejudices of race. In the first century, it was estimated that there were more slaves than there were free men in the Roman Empire. Can you imagine that? That's because that's the way that the imperial administration thought. They had it in their mind that commerce through slave labor, since we don't pay them except just a subsistence, then it must be more profitable than free enterprise. So they thought that it was the way to go. And they really discouraged free trade. They discouraged an individual starting a business on his own. There was also, of the many slaves, there were many that were educated and cultured people, and they held important jobs, important responsibilities. And this was true all back through the history. If you'll remember when the Babylonians, or when Nebuchadnezzar took away all of Judah into Babylonian captivity, there was one man, Daniel, who rose up in the ranks. Daniel spent his entire life as in the courtroom of the king of the Babylonian Empire. Even through the conquest and the end of the Babylonian Empire, Daniel remained in his position in the palace through the first either three or five of the monarchs of the Medo-Persian Empire. He was a capable person. Besides that, God was with him, and God took care of him, and God gave him information. So he always knew what was going on and had the right answers to things. So it was the same with this. Just because a person was taken as a slave in a battle did not mean that wasn't a capable, an intellectual, an educated, a cultured person. And so if they had the capability to do a job, then they may very well have gotten the job to do. There was even a system whereby a slave could hold back part of the value of his service until the time that he might be able to purchase his freedom. Now, I haven't seen the paperwork on that system and have no idea what it might have looked like, but you would certainly want to know that you were working for an absolutely honest person and that you wouldn't get sold to someone else during the process of that. These people were made slaves in many ways. During all of the conquests, to bring these provinces, these other countries and nations into the Roman Empire, many, many people were taken into slavery. And children of the slave class normally remained slaves throughout their life. Many children exposed to this life were found and reared for a long time by foster parents and taken care of. But then sometime in the future, the foster parent might have to sell them into further slavery. Most of this was done because of debt, because of tax burden, primarily because of tax debt. Taxes were so oppressive that just a business downturn or maybe a drought in the crops or something could easily result in a man being sold along with his property to meet his financial obligations. If someone could not secure a loan to pay his taxes by the time the taxes were due, then the man might very well would be taken into slavery. I mentioned a little while ago that the Romans had a contempt for free trade and a person setting up their own business and paying employees and the more humble pursuits in business, the kind of pursuits that created jobs and occupation for people in a healthy society. As a result of all of this, there was a lot of people in the Roman Empire, throughout the Roman Empire, that had no, what we might call today, no visible means of support. And so they would attach themselves to a wealthy individual, a wealthy family, and through flattery and small services that they might provide for these wealthy people, they would give them a subsistence of some sort in return for all of that. The poorest class, which was very large in Rome, was cared for daily with a dole of bread sent out by the state, the central government. This all kind of clarifies Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 26 when he said, "Not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble were called." There weren't many mighty, many noble that were called because there weren't many mighty and there weren't many noble. Throughout the Roman Empire, the people were very, very poor in those days. And it was just the hierarchy, at the people at the top that had the wealth to be able to do things and live above the poverty that was around them. The moral conditions were atrocious in the Roman Empire of those days. Sometimes we think, man, look around in this country today and it just seems like things must be worse than they've ever been in the world. Not so. Things have been worse many, many times before. We think a lot of times that we pay a lot of taxes, and I'm certain I do. But we're not taxed anything like these people were taxed. And if we can't pay it, we're not taken into slavery either. We can work something out to be able to pay the taxes that we owe. But the depraved condition of humanity that the Apostle Paul goes over in Romans chapter 1 can be verified by secular history. As a result of Roman conquest, wealth and luxury was made available to the top people in to the upper classes. Unfortunately, this didn't flow downward, and there wasn't any system whereby it could flow downward through the classes. Some of the excess of the Roman Empire was attributable to the wide use of slavery that we talked about just a little while ago. Women became more depraved than men. And from the court level to the beggar, the whole society was corrupted. This spread through the empire because cities and towns like Antioch and Ephesus and Alexandria and Corinth and other major cities in the Roman Empire were imitators of Rome in its worst excesses. First marriages were usually arranged by parents, and the young people were not acquainted with each other. Divorce became so commonplace in the first century that Seneca, who was an Roman intellectual speaker and writer of the day, referred to women that counted their age by change of husbands. Thought that was funny. The idea of life being sacred was something that was quite foreign to the Roman government as well. Abortion was not discouraged by law, and it was extensively practiced in those days. Abortion procedures were something that were well known and practiced by the physicians of the day. Suicide was considered an open door through which a man might escape the woes of life at any time, and that he had a perfect right to avail himself of it. Pliny the Younger, who was another secular writer of the day that was close to the Roman government in many ways, looked upon death as one of the best gifts given to men by which a man could remove himself from the miseries of life. Seneca, that same intellectual, congratulates the human race on this liberty which is in the reach of us all. So all of this might explain the lack of abhorrence in the tremendous loss of life within the gladiatorial games that they had in the arenas in Rome and in other major cities in the world in the name of sport, where combatants would come into the arena and people would pay to sit in the bleachers and watch them fight to the death, whether it be fighting against one another, or sometimes they would turn wild animals in there, and people would sit and cheer as the wild animals tore them apart. They were enamored and infatuated with bloodshed, and people were working diligently to create more combat equipment and more gruesome games. All of these things were determined by the spectators and what they wanted. So they were always trying to find something more sensational. When Trajan was the Roman Empire, sometime shortly after the turn of the second century, about 112 or 115 or something, he orchestrated a combat event that encompassed over 10,000 combatants, and people paid to come and to watch them and to watch the bloodshed that took place in those great games. So it was just by the moral power of the gospel of Christ that this inhumanity was ever checked. After hearing the ideals of Christ, the contrast was so great that many immediately recognized the fulfillment of the inward desires for a better day and accepted the new faith. The religions of the Roman Empire were exceedingly varied too. The masses of the population were largely illiterate. So that made the imaginations of pagan superstition and idolatry usually acceptable to everyone. After Alexander the Great united the East and the West during his conquest, the free flow of ideas brought to the Western world many of the mysterious religions of the East from Persia and from lands further to the East even than that. I think a lot of these things are important for us to know, that these kinds of things, and there was this great mixture of not only the cult of the deification of the Roman emperor, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, except we're running out of time, and I still got a lot more words here. And I've tried to stay close to my notes because I knew it was a lot of material. I've heard people say before, because there was the great falling away, and we're going to cover this, and we're going to wade through it, but there was the great apostasy, the great falling away due to Greek and Roman Catholicism coming along. And many people wonder, and they'll go, how in the world did we ever get from the religion in Acts, in the book of Acts, to the pomp and circumstance and the cardinals and pope and bishops and things of the Roman Catholic Church and all the sainthoods and things like that? Well, in looking at the world as a whole, as it was in that day, will give us some clues as to how that might have come about, because there was a great mixing of these kinds of things. For instance, one of the mystery religions, and Billy, I hope I'm not getting out of order here, that came from the East was something called Zoroastrianism. Now, Zoroaster was a religion that had been in existence about 500 years before Christ. Now, Zoroaster believed and taught about a good God that was over all things, and that people should follow him, and that he was going to make a better place after life, and that they needed to fight against the evils of the world, and there was this constant struggle between good and evils. He believed and taught that there would be three saviors that would come 1,000 years apart. So it was an interesting religion that was brought in there. And a lot of these things got mixed up with idolatry, and many, many strange religions sprang out of all of this. There are some that says that these teachings of Zoroaster later on became, their God became the God of the Bible. But you know, if you just do a little bit of investigation, you can see clearly that it was probably just the opposite that was true, because those people from the East had come in contact with the Israelites centuries before even the Babylonian captivity, and they had no doubt traded notes about religions and things like that. They probably carried the teachings of Moses back to Persia with them as they went. An obvious characteristic of Roman life was that pagan superstition and idolatry pervaded all conduct. This is the Roman religion that we're talking about now. The worship, but here's the thing that puzzled people, and people continued to look for. And I thought this was a great statement when I saw it. It said, yet the worship of their gods could not bring personal satisfaction or moral improvement. And I had never really thought about it in that way before, but the worship of a stone image or a statue or a temple, worshiping something like that, can neither bring personal satisfaction, because you can derive no purpose of life out of that, nor does it put forward any moral improvement upon society. And I thought it's interesting that the people of the Roman Empire, that's what they were looking for through all of this, and this is what brought about the Roman, or the deification, the cult of emperor worship, really, because they were looking for a deliverer. They wanted a deliverer to come, and they wanted to know who that was, someone that was going to deliver them from this oppression and moral depravity that they were living in. And they thought that certainly the emperor would be that deliverer. But the emperor never was, because the emperor was never religious in nature at all. Outside of Christianity, there really was no conscious relationship between religion and morality. In the pagan religions, a person could be very religious in that they worshipped these stone or wooden deities and temples and things, but then they could be completely immoral at the same time. And it would be acceptable because there was no interchange, no conscious relationship between them. And I'm going to skip ahead. I hope I didn't mess you up, Bill. And then there was the Jewish contribution to all of this. The Christian religion was the culmination of God's plan to save the world through Christ and to show everyone what the purpose for life here is, and to show everyone how to achieve it. Most of the people in the Roman Empire, the poor class, believed that the world was basically evil and that any real life would only be available after death, in some other place and time and in some other way. But before the world would be ready to accept Christ as a Savior, a long period of spiritual preparation had to take place. And through Abraham, God began to reveal himself, and then the law came on Mount Sinai, and it was a great thing, and was the tutor that brought us to Christ. And all of these things had to happen before the church could be established. But in the Jewish religion itself, they broke up into sects, and created their own kind of denominationalism within Judaism. You had the Sadducees, who were conservatives in one sense, but they didn't believe that there was going to be a resurrection. They didn't believe that there would be either reward or punishment after death. They were conservative in that they were against any other religious innovation. They didn't want anything new to come. The Pharisees, on the other side, the Pharisees represented the noble attempt to reform Judaism. They were known as the Puritans of the day, but since Moses' law was given, there emerged this party that wanted to write their own traditions. They believed that many of these traditions were oral commands were given back at the time that the law was given. And so when Jesus came on the earth, they found that many of these traditions had superseded the actual commandments of God in importance. There was the Greek heritage that I'm sure we will cover as time goes on. But in summary, the fullness of time, it was no accident that when Jesus came, it was the perfect time and the perfect place, and the world was so completely prepared for the coming. It was a period of peace. There were good roads, extensive travel and commerce, an exact language known and used throughout the empire. That was certainly a great help in the spread of the gospel. There was the social conditions, slavery, immorality, blatant disregard for human life. And as the doctrine of Christ began to be taught, people saw this standing in great contrast to what they knew. And they thought, and they knew, many knew that this is the answer that we've been looking for. And many people turned to faith in Christ because of the depraved conditions that they knew in the Roman Empire. And we're over our time this morning. And I apologize for that. But I thought it would be good before we start this. Now, we will, next Lord's Day morning, we're going to look at the coming of the church on the day of Pentecost. But I thought it would be a good idea to start out by just taking a look at the world that Jesus knew and the world that the apostles knew and the kind of struggles and difficulties that they had just in getting along from day to day and how that affected the establishment of the new religion and the spread of the gospel around the world. I appreciate so much you being here and your kind attention, and we look forward to the worship service.